Hello, and welcome to Sesquicentennial Stories, a deep dive into the history of Alaska before, during, and after the Alaska Purchase in 1867. Our goal is to tell the story of the 49th state from as many viewpoints as possible, presenting you with some twists on stories you know, and hopefully learning something new along the way. This series is sponsored by the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and this is the first of two parts about the history of mandated boarding schools for Alaska Natives. My guest is Reverend Dr. Michael James Alexa, who has written several books on Alaska Native culture and history. To tell the story, we decided to start at the beginning. Can you talk to me a little bit about what life was like for Alaska Native students before the Alaska Purchase, before the American government came in?
Yes, the first schools in Alaska were founded in 1804 by Father Gideon, the father confessor of Tsar Alexander I, who was sent here on an inspection tour. But he spent enough time in Kodiak specifically to learn the language, devise an alphabet for Aleutic, and open the first school in Alaska that we know of, where the native kids were taught to read and write in their own language as well as in Russian. So they were graduating bilingual students very early in Alaska history. Here in Sitka, the first Tlingit College graduate was being brought back to Sitka as a ship architect on the Neva, which sank, of course, in 1813. But that means that there were Tlingits being sent off to Russian universities almost as early as there was contact with the Russians. The Russian government forbade Russians to settle permanently in Alaska. That this was not Jamestown or Plymouth Rock. You couldn't come here and live. You could come here to work for the Russian-American company, but when your contract expired, by law, you had to return to Russia. Those who were allowed to stay were those who had married into the Native Alaskan Native community. So the school here in Sitka was the all-colonial school starting in 1842 in called the Russian Bishop's House. It's a pretty big house. It was really mostly a school, dormitory, and classrooms on the first floor, where Alaska Natives from all over the state, mostly Aleuts, but also Tlingit people and Aleutics, later Yupiks, were taught to be cartographers, accountants, shipbuilders, carpenters, school teachers, priests, musicians, painters. So pretty much anything that the colony needed personnel-wise, the Native Alaskan people were being, Alaska Native people were being taught to fill those positions, because the Russians were much more interested in colonizing Siberia. They had just acquired the area where the Amur Valley, where Vladivostok, the southernmost Russian port on the Pacific, stands. They were vitally concerned about that. If Alaska was going to become anything of a colony, it was going to be run by Alaska Native people. Wow, so that was the policy before the sale of Alaska. It's really important, I think, to acknowledge the schooling effort, the educational effort, operated by the Orthodox Church, that was bilingual, multicultural, and where Sitka was sort of the last stop before. If you were going to go to Russia, you came to Sitka first and got your what the equivalent of a high school junior college degree. And then Alaska Natives were graduating from the Russian Naval Academy. There were sea captains in the Russian Navy who were Alaska Native graduates of the Sitka School. Most of Alaska was mapped by graduates of the Sitka School. There was a major general from Kodiak, Alexander Koshevarov, who graduated from the Russian Naval Academy, and he with Nikolai Chernov mapped the North Slope. It's the last part of the whole world to be mapped, but it was mapped by Alaska Natives.
And what was the effect of that on Alaska Native culture?
I would say that the people who call themselves Aleuts today are actually from several different tribes. When they call themselves Aleut, whether they speak Unangan or Aleutic or even Yupik, what they're claiming is, my ancestors were the intelligentsia. They were the blue and white collar workers in the Russian era of Alaska's history. And we were, and even into the 20th century, are multilingual and multiliterate. The founder of the Alaska Native, the Alaska State Historical Museum and the Alaska State Historical Library was a Kodiak Aleut man, Andrew Koshevarov, who could read, write, and speak Tlingit, Aleut, English, and Russian. So even into the 20th century, there were, you could say, the alumni or the product of that earlier Russian educational effort that were still with us and still have an important effect on the history of Alaska even into the 20th century. But then with the transfer of Alaska to American rule, the policies changed radically. We should remember that after the Civil War, there was a labor shortage in the United States, so the U.S. invited Eastern and Southern Europeans to come as laborers, miners and steel mill workers, mostly factory workers and miners, who came from Italy, Poland, Greece, the Balkan Peninsula, and the Baltic states, as well as Russia. And they came into the eastern part of the United States with a totally different languages, cultures, and religions. The people in the lower 48, mostly Anglos, of course, who had come on the Mayflower, were kind of startled by all of this. And they instituted public schools to assimilate the immigrants, to teach them how to speak English, become patriotic, abandon their previous cultures and histories, and become a kind of generic American in the image of the Mayflower pilgrims. It worked for them because those immigrants had made a conscious decision to come to a new country and become something they had not been before, and also because they had a country to go back to. The survival of their culture and language was not their responsibility. When that policy was then applied to Alaska Native people, neither of those applied. They had not decided to go someplace else and become something they were not. They were minding their own business in their own villages. And if they assimilated into the dominant culture, they become accomplices in the demise and extinction of their language and culture. So while public schooling in the 19th century style was successful for the immigrants, it was hardly ever successful for the indigenous peoples of North America.
You're listening to Sesquicentennial Stories, a production of the Sitka Historical Society and the Sitka History Museum. I'm Emmett Williams, and I'm talking to Reverend Dr. Michael James Alexa about the history of the Alaska-mandated boarding schools. If I read correctly the history, the people who set this into law and were doing this, they actually thought they were doing a good thing. They thought they were civilizing.
Exactly. They called it civilizing. And the Treaty of Sale, the treaty transferring Alaska from Russian rule to American, specifically says that Alaska Native people will be given citizenship in the U.S. Form, except the tribes that were not civilized. Well, then an Aleut or a Tlingit who could read and write in his own language and at least one or maybe two European languages certainly considered themselves civilized. But when they tried to vote or when they tried to exercise any rights of citizenship, they were denied as uncivilized if they still spoke their native language. So the pressure was to abandon everything related to your native identity in order to be accepted into the American system. And sending the kids off to boarding schools was the final step with the policy, with the hope that they would probably never come back, although no one said that out loud when they left.
And this idea of civilizing, it's not just an American idea, correct?
What we should recognize is that these attitudes are ancient, that 1,000 years ago in Central Europe, when the Slavic tribes, specifically in what is now the Czech Republic, wanted to become, by their own initiative, civilized, they were told by the local Germans they could be civilized if they gave up their Slavic language and adopted Latin as the only proper language of civilization. They balked at this. They sent delegates to Constantinople, to the eastern part of Europe, where there was still a department of linguistics at the university, who sent them books in Slavonic, so that they got educated in their own language without giving it up. But the attitude in Western Europe was, if you want to be civilized, you have to do it our way, which, of course, in medieval Europe meant Latin. 1,000 years later, on the streets of Sitka, the same debate raged between the Russian Bishop's House and Sheldon Jackson College. The Russian Bishop's House, embodying the Eastern position, was training Alaska Natives to read and write in several languages and sending them out to universities in Europe and Asia. The Americans said that was uncivilized, that to be civilized, you had to give up your traditional, what they called barbarian language, and adopt English as the only way to be civilized. So the two attitudes, the Western one came around the world across the United States to Sitka in the 1860s, and the eastern one came across Russia and came to Sitka in the 1860s, and the two schools clashed philosophically right here on the streets of Lincoln Street in the center of Sitka.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that were taken away? Like, I know that a lot of Alaska Native culture centered around, the community houses and the gathering, right, and using and being
the US
there for each
the US
other.
The U.S. government went so far as to forbid potlatches as something illegal. The speaking of the native languages in public, illegal. The use of native languages in the schools, illegal. Literally against the law. We have cases on the Pribilof Island where parents were arrested for speaking Unangan, speaking Aleut to their kids, and the school being actually forcibly closed by federal authorities because the local Orthodox village school was still using Russian and Aleut. They were using English, too. They were graduating students who could read and write three languages, but that was no good. It was English, and the important word here, only English. Do it our way and only our way, and don't include anything else. And anything else is a kind of pollution or a degradation, what the Americans simply considered barbarian. And if you were still barbarian, you couldn't be a citizen. So the pressure was certainly on to assimilate totally and renounce everything to do with Native culture, which the immigrants did relatively freely for the reasons I already gave. They weren't responsible for keeping their original language alive. There was still a country back in Europe or the Middle East where that language and culture was still thriving. So you lose your spirit, I would say. The real loss is not in what you eat or what you read or how you talk. It's your identity. And you lose the positive sense of being who you are. There was at least one village here in Southeast who renounced being Tlingit. I mean, if you can renounce your entire heritage, it's like a plant renouncing its roots. It can't thrive. In fact, it can't even survive. And that was exactly the experience in that community. They wound up within 50 or 60 years with an extraordinarily high suicide rate. People were killing themselves because they could no longer feel pride in their history, in their culture, in their identity. They could no longer be proud to be human beings, which after all is what Tlingit means. We have to be something else, but we can't be human beings anymore.
Part of the reason that happens is because the way that people can deal with trauma is taken away from them.
Exactly. Their sense of control, of identity, of of having a personal or collective responsibility and power over your own life is gone. The greatest tragedy, I think, of the last 100 years is to have almost systematically taught people, you can't. We can, you can't. And that's with political rights. We can vote. We have control. You have no say. You have no control. So people will sacrifice whatever they need to in order to regain some control. And that meant for citizens, well, for Tlingit people 100 years ago, renouncing your Tlingit language, culture, and identity in order to become a citizen, in order to vote, in order to have any say-so in how your community was going to be governed.
You've been listening to Sesquicentennial Stories with special guest Father Alexa. In the second part of this two-part episode, we'll talk about how the Alaska Natives wrote letters, signed petitions, and lobbied the U.S. government for their rights. This series is sponsored by the Sitka History Museum and the Sitka Historical Society, with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, the Sitka Legacy Fund, and KCAW Sitka. This series is produced by Mission Man Media. Jeff Budd is the executive producer. I'm Emmett Williams, and thanks for listening.